Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 4th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. A lot happening, Mike. We're going to start with G20, but we're going to spend some time in the news today having a look at the Jersey child abuse report, which came out yesterday.
Yeah, indeed. So this is a wild week as we head towards the G20 on Friday. Western establishment in a state of panic, it seems, over what might happen if Donald Trump meets Presidents Putin and Xi. And as a result, they seem to have deployed every asset in their arsenal to try and, you know, sour the pitch a little bit before any such meeting. So German security forces expecting 8,000 agents provocateurs, violent protesters is how they're describing them, to converge on Hamburg. And 20,000 police officers are going to be there to secure the event. Merkel said that her birthplace of Hamburg was a beacon of free trade and almost predestined to host the G20 gathering. But the police themselves less excited about the prospect. Their representative said, "Many of my colleagues and I find it incomprehensible that another big city has been chosen for such a gathering after the terrible events of Genoa. Why Hamburg when you could have held G20 in, say, a forest in Bavaria or whatever?" So the police questioning the decision to have this in Hamburg, and you might almost wonder, if you're feeling a little conspiratorial, you might wonder why they chose to have it there. Did they want the violence?
Well, I certainly think they want violence in Europe. They want violence in UK, Mike, because violence enables the state to bring in the rapid emergency measures. And that essentially means you can bring in your dictatorship overnight, as we've seen in France.
Well, that is true. But I think they're also wanting to make sure the headlines are full of that rather than what might be happening in the G20 itself. And in the meantime, speaking of arsenal, of course, North Korea firing a missile yesterday. And China not so happy about that. They've called on North Korea to abide by United Nations Security Council resolutions. They said the United Nations Security Council has made decisions concerning North Korea and its technologies, as well as its activities. We call on Pyongyang to abide by the decisions. At the moment, the parties need to maintain restraint and refrain from actions that could lead to rising tensions. Well, that may be the case. But of course, the United States not so keen to avoid rising tensions, at least certain factions within the U.S. establishment anyway, as they send a destroyer, the USS Stethern, to sail within the 12-mile limit around Triton Island. This is in the Paracels. And they didn't admit that they've done this, but they did say, "We conduct routine and regular operations as we've done in the past and will continue to do in the future." Now, we should point out here that Triton is not one of these manufactured islands that are sort of in contention with the Chinese. They are part of the Paracels. And they have been recorded on Chinese records since about 2,000 years ago, Brian, so you can't exactly say that they're not, you know, that there's any dispute over these particular islands. So this was
a little bit pre-USA, we might say, in a historical sense.
Well, that's true, but clearly the United States must understand what they're doing when they sail within the 12-mile limit under those circumstances.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And I just find it interesting that all the fingers pointed at North Korea because they're firing military hardware as a test. Well, we've got America, of course, firing its military hardware, certainly not as a test.
Absolutely. But, you know, so this is all designed to, I believe, to sort of cause angst in the run-up to the G20. But in the meantime, in the run-up to the G20, we have this, because President Xi arrived in Moscow yesterday for his 22nd meeting with President Putin. And this has been billed as the event of the year in Russia. So they had an informal dinner at the Kremlin last night, and the official meeting starts today. Full-fledged talks between the two leaders. Of course, Belt and Road, the Silk Road being the main part of this. And then a special ceremony being held after the talks when Putin will award President Xi the Order of St. Andrew for his distinguished service, they say, to the peoples of China and Russia. As I say, the media in China calling this the event of the year and writing that vast opportunities are seen in the pairing of the China-proposed Belt and Road Initiative and the Russia-led Eurasian Economic Union, which is also on the agenda of the upcoming talks between the two heads of state. China is, the Russians said that China is not just our closest neighbour, but also our main trade and economic partner. And so it goes on. Now, prior to arriving in Moscow then, Xi Jinping was speaking to the Russian media, and he said, well, President Putin and I have built a good working relationship and a close personal friendship. So this clearly becoming the major dynamic of the G20. And I think for the first time, there are questions being asked about who is the actual powerhouse of the G20, because normally it's been the United States. And, well, we seem to be seeing a different dynamic developing here.
Yeah. And interesting, the contrast was it another 10 billion pounds or dollars worth of deals between the Chinese and the Russians right. that I was reading about yesterday. And you look at the scale of that friendship and compare it to Xi's invite to fish and chips with David Cameron a while ago on the nuclear power plant issue, which seems to have gone into the long grass.
Yes. So, you know, this is the context that the G20 is going to be taking place. Well, as I say, the West, or at least certain factions from the West, perhaps City of London and those types, not happy if Trump were to actually perhaps think about bringing the United States into the Belt and Road Initiative. This was the comments from the Undersecretary of State on this. He said that they're going to follow up on recent conversations between Secretary of State Tillerson and Sergey Lavrov in the lead up to the G20. So where this actually ends up, we will have to watch with interest.
Indeed. Well, let's move on to Jersey, because the Jersey report was reported by the BBC some 19 hours ago, but it doesn't seem to have taken any sort of mainstream position in BBC reporting. Let's have a look at what that report says. We're going to say from the outset that it's an extremely clever piece of whitewash. So we'll bring in the main lady. This is Frances Oldham QC. And she announced the findings of the inquiry, which I've paraphrased here, really. But she said there were failings at all levels and across a range of departments, but nobody was really to blame. The states of Jersey proved to be an ineffectual and neglectful substitute parent. I found that a very interesting expression, Mike. What was going to happen is there was going to be a commissioner for children brought in. Now, of course, in other places there are commissioners for children. That absolutely hasn't stopped the abuse of children. But now we've got some of her solutions. She's going to rebrief corporate parents. And if you're listening and don't understand what that expression means, well, if you have local councillors, for example, they have a responsibility to protect children in care within their own local authority's catchment area, and in that role they're known as corporate parents. This is a very interesting approach. She talks about the Jersey Way. Now, this is spin. The Jersey Way was initially criticism of the fact that the old culture of Jersey was blocking attempts to have a look at what was happening with the children. But this is now being spun into, well, the Jersey Way can also be the way forward. So this is all good news. But the main part of the report, certainly in the executive summary, leaves the abusers untouched, because nobody's really interested in who abused the children. That doesn't quite seem to be important in this inquiry, but it is important that the old buildings of Hôte de la Garenne Children's Home are demolished as quickly as possible.
Because if you get rid of the building, you can just forget about the whole deal afterwards?
Can get rid of the whole deal. And we're going to say this is a very, very skillful whitewash by the team under this lady. Job done. No real abuse. Nobody really to blame. We're going to move on with the state taking more power as a corporate parent. So let's have a look at some of the reports. This is The Guardian here. Jersey Care Home Abuse Inquiry says children may still be at risk. Now, that statement's absolutely true. And of course, it would be true by the sheer fact that the inquiry has not really suggested that anyone should look for the people who've abused the children. So although they were talking about children being locked up, sexually abused, physically abused, thrashed with sticks and stinging nettles, if, for example, some of them wet the bed in various of the children's homes, it wasn't really any one person that did this. It was only the institutions. But you can see The Guardian there very quick to point out that they should demolish Haute de la Garenne there. So get rid of the evidence is a good way to go. So let's have a look at the executive summary. Now, we've spent a little bit of time on this morning and encourage people to get online and have a look at it. Our remit has been to establish what went wrong in Jersey's childcare system over many decades. There were failings. That there were failings is not in dispute. Those failings impacted on children already at a disadvantage, whether through family circumstances, a crime committed against the child, or even a crime committed by the child. For many children who were removed from home situations deemed harmful or unsatisfactory, the states of Jersey proved to be an ineffectual and neglectful substitute parent. So that opening paragraph, Mike, is just, it's so skillfully crafted, because, of course, what they don't say is that children were being abused, tortured, locked up in solitary confinement. There were just failings. We're aware there were failings. And then they go on to say that on the 6th of December 2010, Jersey's chief minister made a formal apology to all those who'd suffered abuse in the state's residential care system. He acknowledged that the system had failed in a serious way. So this is all part of the manipulation of language. So they're only going to have a look at what went wrong. They're not looking at the abuse of children. They're looking at what went wrong. And these were simply failings. This was no criminal acts. This was simply a few failings in a system to protect children. And, well, relax, because the states of Jersey were the real parent. But in this case, they were ineffectual and a little bit neglectful. Mm-hmm. So the scene is set quite well. Let's have a look at the man they're talking about. Here he is, Ian Gorst. And this is what he said in March 2013. It's the right thing to do for victims of abuse who want to recount their experiences to an independent inquiry. It's the right thing to do for our community, so we can be assured that we've done everything possible to establish what went wrong and then to ensure it does not happen again. So there's nothing in there about justice. Well, probably we can put that in a better way. I paraphrased him here because he doesn't want to promote justice and compensation for the survivors of abuse, nor does he want those responsible for the abuse brought to justice, because nobody's talking about that at all. The main thing is to blame the institutions, not individuals, learn the lessons, bury the whole thing, and get Haute de la Garenne demolished as soon as possible.
Good stuff.
It's good stuff. And I think the beauty about this report, Mike, is that I think this is going to be the exact style of the report that we're going to see when the equivalent for England and Wales comes out. Mm. This is what we can expect, which is very carefully worded document where there's a lot of words, there's a lot of paragraphs, there's a lot of comment, but nobody is actually to blame. So what has this gentleman said recently? Well, he said this: too often children are not believed. Unpalatable truths were swept under the carpet because it was the easiest thing to do. But he's deeply sorry. We did not do what we should have done. People cared more for the status quo, for a quiet life, than for children. And he gets quite emotional because he goes on to say, I will not rest until we've done all that we can do to change that. I accept every recommendation and pledge to build a new culture, one which puts children first every time. And I've added an oh, really, because this is what is always said and nothing changes, Mike. So is this man part of this skillful transformational speech which is being used to cover this up? Well, I think he knows exactly what he's saying. And all that has happened is the recommendations are suggesting that nothing should really change. So why should we be interested in the demolishing of Hope de la Grenne? Well, let's bring in Beechwood Children's Home, because, of course, this was the home where Melanie Shaw blew the whistle on children being abused, Beechwood Children's Home in Nottingham. And no full police forensic investigation ever took place at that property. The police did attend on site. They dug one small hole. They did not fully process Melanie's information. They certainly didn't visit the site at a time when there were still children's records in one of the basement areas. And then as Operation Daybreak was being progressed, the council simply sold the site off to a local property developer who just happened to live quite close to Beechwood itself. And within a few days, all of the buildings were pulled down. And of course, the ground built over, presumably, that would allow any forensic evidence in the ground to be disposed of quite happily.
Now, in the case of Hope de la Grenne, of course, there was some forensic investigation done. And if I remember correctly, there was a basement with milk teeth found. The significance of that is understood by anybody that's involved in the child abuse in the investigation of child abuse. Is quite horrible. But the question is, was there any mention of this incident in this report?
In the body of the report, there is, Mike. I didn't have time before this news to get into that. But what you can see in the executive summary is that detail of what was happening in the police investigations, that's really a sideline. Because what you have is a huge block of historical information going back to 1945, time periods which mean almost impossible to investigate anything. And then hidden in amongst that is the fact, well, there was a bit of trouble over the police investigation, but the inference I see from the executive summary is that they don't really believe the police investigation. And we can add a bit more to that. So where can we go? Well, let's bring in this one, which is Operation Rectangle, which is part of the police investigation. And there was a gentleman called Mr. Power who was helping to run that. And we'll just read a bit of this part of the report. In terms of political involvement in Operation Rectangle, the police investigation, we accept Mr. Power's view that initially politicians did not grasp the urgency and importance of the investigation or the need to prepare for media and public interest and scrutiny. We concluded also that the initial lethargic political response was due to this failure rather than any attempt to impede the investigation. Now, I'm going to say to people who are listening to this, please remember that sentence. We concluded also that the initial lethargic political response was due to this failure rather than any attempt to impede the investigation. They go on to say, we set out in the report in detail the events surrounding the public announcement of Operation Rectangle, which was precipitated by former Senator Sivray's invitation to the BBC to make a programme about historical abuse in Jersey. So it was Senator Sivray's work. I'll just bring in a picture of the policeman, Mr. Power. This is an article from the Guardian, and the caption is, Jersey secrecy culture led to my suspension, says former police chief. So this man gets suspended. He blames a secrecy culture. But in the report, it's all initial lethargic political response. And it takes one man, Senator Sivray, to stand up and invite in the BBC. So I'm just going to underline a bit of this. This is the key bit. The politicians simply didn't understand things. We go on. It was all a failure. And it was his Senator Savary who brought in the BBC. So let's move on to the Senator. And the report says this. We've briefly recounted in the report the events following on from Senator Savary's scathing public criticisms of the performance of his own department, of which he'd been minister for 8 years, to his dismissal as minister. We find that Stuart Savary highlighted relevant issues about child abuse that needed to be addressed to ensure the protection and safety of children in Jersey. His actions did not amount to political interference with Operation Rectangle. So this man was vilified. He eventually appeared in court on data protection charges. His career was destroyed. This was the man who took the lid off the abuse. Mm. They admit that. They also say he didn't interfere with the police operation. But they go on. We agree that Mr. Savary's public criticisms of civil servants were inappropriate and did not assist his cause. We accept that Frank Walker and Bill Oakley were genuinely troubled by his conduct in this respect, and we do not believe that the attempts to remove him were conducted with the intention of covering up child abuse. In those circumstances, further consideration of the reasons for and the manner of his removal from post does not fall within our terms of reference. So the inquiry just decides that the man that blew the lid off it and is subsequently kicked out of his job, that was, well, they don't really understand what that was about.
But it wasn't about covering up child abuse.
No.
And in any case, it doesn't fall within the terms of reference.
So, no.
So they're not going to look at it any closer.
No. You don't want to do that, really.
No.
Okay. So now we're getting into the excellent executive summary. And my goodness, we could really go to town on this if we had more time. Let's bring in this man. This is where it gets really interesting. This is Sir Philip Bailhache. He was a former Attorney General and Jersey bailiff. And he said this in May 2008, all child abuse, wherever it happens, is scandalous. But it is the unjustified and remorseless denigration of Jersey and her people that is the real scandal. So according to this man, it doesn't really matter if there's child abuse going on. It's the reputation of Jersey that we've got to protect at all costs.
Yes.
That's pretty good from that man, isn't it? And he figures highly in the report. I went to have a little look at him, and in no time at all, I found this. Ex-Jersey judge unaware he let sex offender into the police. So it was an unfortunate mistake, Mike.
Yes.
Highly experienced politician and lawyer. He simply didn't know.
So the feeling I'm getting so far, Brian, is that there's lots of unfortunate mistakes. Nobody knew anything, and nobody was deliberately attempting to cover anything up. It was all just errors and mistakes.
Yes. Yeah, all unfortunate. So let's see how unfortunate those mistakes were. So this is part of the abuse report text in 10.28. We've considered whether Sir Philip's words indicated a belief on his part that the reputation of Jersey was of more importance than child abuse investigation. We cannot accept that a politician and lawyer of his experience would inadvertently have made what he told the inquiry was an unfortunate juxtaposition of words. So the inquiry says they can't accept that when this man said, I made an unfortunate mistake in the choice of my words, they can't accept that because of his experience as a politician and a lawyer.
So what they're saying is that they believe he lied.
Well, they don't say that, of course, but maybe this paragraph helps us with that a little bit, because they go on to say this. We are sure that the way in which Jersey is perceived internationally matters greatly to him. His linking of Jersey's reputation to the child abuse investigation was, we are satisfied, a grave political error rather than a considered attempt to influence the course of the police investigation. So how do you reconcile those two paragraphs, Mike? Because I had big problems with this. On one hand, they say it can't have possibly been a mistake of words, the man is too experienced. And then they say, oh, well, we're satisfied. It was a grave political error.
Well, the only way that I could reconcile this is to say that this report is a cover-up.
This report is a cover-up of enormous proportions. And it's very interesting that we're focusing around this gentleman. So we can put the two things side by side, his original statement and the fact he made a little mistake about a policeman who'd been abusing a disabled girl. So we've got a bit more from the inquiry. We accept the evidence of the then Attorney General, William Bailhache QC, who understood that the decision to suspend Graham Power, the policeman, had already been made by the evening of the 11th of November 2008, in advance of the meeting of Mr. Ogilvy and Andrew Lewis the following day. His evidence to us on this point was at odds with the evidence of Bill Ogilvy. We prefer the evidence of Mr. Bailhache. It's clear to us that when Graham Power attended the meeting on the 12th of November 2008, his suspension was inevitable. We accept Graham Power's evidence that he was given time to, quote, consider his position, in other words, to resign as an alternative to suspension.
So if I get this right, Brian, this is not about discovering the truth. This is about discovering preferences.
Yes. Yeah. We prefer the evidence of this gentleman who's already made grave mistakes. I've sort of summarised it here. We've got this man who's the experienced politician and lawyer. He makes what he says an unfortunate juxtaposition of words. That's then renamed a grave political error, which the investigation says he's really incapable of making such an error because of his experience. He's unaware of a sex offender, but they prefer his evidence. So that's pretty good, isn't it? We can just prefer which evidence we choose to accept.
Well, of course, you would have to do that if what you're wanting is to build a narrative. You would have to prefer some evidence over other, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Now, remember that the chair lady of this inquiry said she was quite convinced that the authorities were just a little bit sort of slow to react, a little bit incompetent, a little bit sluggish. Well, she seems to have forgotten this report that she made, where, according to the BBC, she reported a little while ago, 2015, that state departments and law officers were hampering the inquiry.
But the final report seems to suggest that that was not the case.
Well, certainly not in the executive summary. We need to get into the main report. But I, at this stage, I started to get a little bit interested in how this lady's mind worked. So what are the fundamental failings? Well, there's 10 of them. Failure to value children in the care system, listen to them, ensure they're nurtured and give them adequate opportunities to flourish in childhood and beyond. Failure to have in place an adequate legislative framework that prioritises the welfare of children in need or at risk. Failure to keep pace with developments in social policy, childcare practice and social work standards in the developed world. Failure to plan and deliver services in an effective, targeted manner to achieve positive, measurable outcomes. Failure to establish a culture of openness and transparency, leading to a perception, at least, of collusion and cover-up. It was only a perception.
Just a perception.
It was only just a perception.
Mere conspiracy theory, perhaps.
Yes, absolutely. Failure to mitigate negative effects of small island culture and its challenges. I think that's transformational speak for the fact that there was a cover-up at high level. A failure to make sufficient investment in staff development and training.
They couldn't have common purpose in there.
They couldn't recruit the right staff. Mm. So that was the problem. Failure to adopt policies which would promote the recruitment and retention of staff with essential skills in child welfare, child protection. Failure of the states of Jersey to understand and fulfil corporate parenting responsibilities, including adequate aftercare of children who have been looked after by the state. And this one, which I love, the failure to tackle a silo mentality amongst public sector agencies.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the silo, the use of the silo expression is pure common purpose. But we notice in those failings, there's no actual mention of the fact that people were torturing, abusing, beating children, putting them in solitary confinement. These are simply institutional errors and mistakes. Mm. Nothing too much to worry about. So what are the recommendations? Well, let's have a look at this. I can only give you a bit of this. Many recommendations made over the years in previous reviews have focused predominantly on developing processes, structures and procedures instead of identifying and setting out a roadmap for pursuing desirable outcomes and for transforming service users' experience. Is a service user a child who's in the care system, Mike?
I believe that in this case that would be the case.
Yes, transforming service users' experience. We have sought to avoid this and have also set out in the report some features that we believe should be part of an approach by the states of Jersey to these recommendations. The key changes required are not procedural, but cultural. And the Jersey way should be one of intolerance of poor performance, having highest aspirations for every child in the island, commitment to securing the best quality services. And it goes on, Mike, in language which I find quite obscene, because it's using managerial newspeak to absolutely ignore that the subject of the inquiry was the vicious abuse of children. So we'll leave our audience to have a think about that report. I encourage you to go and have a look at that executive summary. If you feel as outraged as we do, then move on to have a look at the full reports. And of course, this lady and her team should be challenged at every available opportunity, because our prediction is you will see in the English and the Welsh child abuse inquiry a similar skillful use of newspeak to cover up the facts that vile crimes have been committed against children.
And well, let's move on to another inquiry. Of course, it is an inquiry, not an inquest. It is a judge-led inquiry, just like in Jersey, and not a jury-led inquest. Now, yesterday, Sajid Javid was in the House of Commons, and he said this about the inquiry: "Mr. Speaker, the people affected by the disaster at Grenfell Tower need our assistance, and they are receiving it. But they also want answers. Sir Martin Moore-Bick has been appointed to lead a full independent inquiry. He has visited Kensington. He has met victims and survivors, as well as members of the local community who have done so much to help. After consulting with the community, Sir Martin will then advise on the terms of the inquiry, and we will ensure there's legal support for victims so that they can play a full part." So Sir Martin Moore-Bick gets to choose the terms of reference of this inquiry, okay? And of course, in the media, they had to admit that his appointment was, as the media said, met with concern by survivors. Met with concern, I think, doesn't even come close to how they feel about this man being in charge, because, of course, he has history in the area, because he had previously, aside from trying to limit the scope of this inquiry, he had been involved in moving people out of, in the decisions to move people out, some decanting of people, if you remember the term from yesterday, in the past. So he has history. But he has now been forced by pressure from the local people to include the issue of how this fire came about in the first place. So he was attempting to shut down or to limit the scope of the inquiry. And he's now saying that he's quite happy to look at why people's warnings of fire risk were not listened to. That was never going to be part of this inquiry. He was going to make sure that it wasn't part of the inquiry. But actually, the local people have managed to get together and force that issue, which is really good. Now, the local MP then, Emma Dent Code, who's a Labour MP for Kensington, actually wants to see the back of him. He doesn't think that he should be part of this inquiry before, because of his history in the area. And so she said, "How anybody like that could have empathy for what these people have been through, I don't understand. He's a technocrat, and he's not really what's needed right now. We need someone who can understand human beings and what they've been through. I don't think he should do it. I don't think there can be any credibility. Some people are saying they're not going to cooperate with it, and so it's not going to work. Well, of course, that's the intention.
Of course.
At least one mainstream news outlet, The Mirror, I thought we would highlight this because their headline here is "Heroic Grenfell Tower Firefighters Gagged from Talking About Horrors Amid Fears Death Toll Could Rise Above 100. Now, they're still downplaying the numbers, but they're highlighting an issue because somebody, I think it was Alex last week, mentioned somebody who'd spoken to him and said, well, why aren't the firefighters speaking out about this? And of course, they're being gagged.
Yeah.
Well, this is the first mainstream acknowledgement of that fact.
And the sub-headline there, I think, is interesting, Mike. The order came from bosses, has been revealed by several fire brigade sources who grimly insist the official figure of 80 dead will soar.
Soar is the word, yeah. Absolutely. So we're starting to see this dribble out and drip out, but still no official acknowledgement. If they say it's going to keep on like this until the end of the year, tensions have got to be building, and particularly if this inquiry is mishandled.
Indeed. And we'll say a big thank you to all of the people from the London end who've been feeding us with information and telling us about the concerns of the local community. So if you're watching this news, thank you very much for that information. And we're going to do everything we can to help get the truth out about what has happened around the Grenfell Tower fire. But it's quite clear already that, of course, what the government isn't doing is an open and transparent public inquiry into the circumstances of the fire and that key point of exactly how many people have died.
Okay, moving over to Syria then, into Astana at least, but the Syrian peace talks have started again, another round, and taking place today and tomorrow, bringing together delegations from Russia, Iran, Turkey, as well as from Syria, and also from the United Nations. Jordan and the United States are going to act as observers at this. And Sputnik actually was told by a source that the result of this round of talks, guarantors will announce the beginning of the operation to monitor the de-escalation zones and to define the exact nature of those de-escalation zones. That's as good as they can do at this point. They're saying the joint working group of the three guarantor states will run the whole operation, so guarantors can also specify in the final agreement some procedures for the group, and they're now working on those procedures. So another round of Astana talks, that can only be a good thing. We're going to end on this one, Brian, or this subject, moving back to the UK. This is the Chief Medical Officer, Dame Sally Davis, and she has apparently set out recommendations in this report. The report is called Generation Genome, and apparently we're going to democratize genomic medicine. Does that make you feel good?
No.
Okay. Well, this apparently involves using genetic information from patients as part of clinical care. So it means the routine genetic fingerprinting of everybody is what we're looking at here. So centralized laboratory provision, because she's complaining that there are 25 separate laboratories, genetic laboratories operating around the country, different service levels and different conditions being offered in different parts of the country. And she's saying that genomic medicine has had huge implications for the understanding and treatment of rare cancers and other infections. Now, of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but of course, this type of genetic database on this scale would be of extreme interest to insurance companies as well.
Of course, and insurance companies, obviously, and their banking controllers at the back of everything that happens in government and public service.
So, okay, so she's saying that she wants to reduce the overall number of labs. So she's calling these 25 laboratories in the country a cottage industry. We've got to shut down this cottage industry and centralise control of it. Smaller number, but larger scale. Reorganise them centrally. She says this will be more money to spend across more patients. And apparently greater concentration of data makes it easier to define disease patterns or to identify disease patterns. So that's all really good. But then we come on to this story from The Independent, and perhaps this gives us some context actually for what's going on here, Brian, because the headline in The Independent is, within 30 years, we will no longer use sex to procreate. And this is according to a Stanford University lecturer called Hank Greeley. And he's saying that basically the reproductive process would begin with parents choosing from a range of embryos created in a lab with their DNA. This might, you know, cause potential problems between, but I mean, these are not insurmountable problems between partners as to which embryo you would choose. Would it be the one with blue eyes or the one with brown eyes? Would it be the one with blonde hair or the one with black hair or red hair, perhaps? So he recognizes that this might cause problems. But what, correct me if I'm wrong, but what we seem to have here is the absolute promotion by the Independent newspaper of eugenics.
This is truly horrible, Mike, and what's in my head is 1984 and children and incubators and sort of being farmed, the children being farmed, and this is taking us there. And these people are promoting this without any real challenge from the public.
Right.
People should be outraged at the ideas that these individuals have put forward. Sorry, while you were reporting that, I was just having a look. Apparently this lady's been on a salary of £215,000 a year, making her one of the top, highest paid civil servants. So she's clearly got some power. And this is the sort of thing that that salary allows her to do. And of course, this is going to happen unless we, the wider public, stand up and say, we're just not having this nonsense.
Mm. That's it.
Hidden in plain sight. Well, what can we say? Please do your own research into the Charl report. In fact, do your own research into everything that we report on UK Column News. It's important that you read and see for yourselves that what we're talking about is correct. But if you want to understand how the British government functions at the moment, of course, our politicians are either involved in the abuse of children, or they are helping to cover up the abuse of children, or they're actually involved by their silence on the subject of the abuse of children. This is becoming very clear. And if we have a government that's prepared to abuse and cover up the abuse of children, then policies like children created in a factory is well within their remit. Mm. So at the end of the day, it's up to all of us to say, no, we're not having this. Thanks for joining us today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.